Welcome to the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chods. They're old, grumpy, and are pretty opinionated. Here's your host, it's Mark and Jamie.
Hello and welcome to episode 84 of the Carpcast. How are we today, Mark?
I'm feeling very relaxed.
Yeah?
Just sat here with a coffee, just eating a couple of flapjacks, you know, got my feet up and about to talk crap about fishing for however long.
Yeah.
Trying not to bore people.
Hopefully we won't. Bit more regular, these podcasts now. The bulk of the fishing season's open. I still might get out and do the odd social. We did promise one with Paul Harris last week, didn't we? Do you reckon anybody saw that? Is that about 1,500 views or something? I had that a week ago. I hadn't looked recently. But if you didn't know, we did a live broadcast. Mark and I were doing an interview with Paul Harris. It had been booked in for a little while. For those of you who don't know Paul, I think he'll be on next week's show. I'm going to use my interview with Mark Bartlett this week. But Mark and I used to interview people together. Paul was one of our friends. We met on Elstow 2 many years ago now. How long ago was that, Mark?
Oh, 15 plus, something like that.
Wow, we're getting old, aren't we? So yeah, Paul was one of the first people I come into contact that was sort of writing in magazines. He was a regular contributor to Big Carp, Rotary Letter, and he's just written a book. But he's not a household name, he's not a name that's put himself around, but he's a very good angler. He fishes one night a week and has done for 30 years plus, I would say. He's a working guy, he's got a daughter now. Has he got two kids or one?
Just the one I'm aware of. But did you notice as well when we were doing the recording, as you say there, we've all got older. Yeah, he's the oldest out of the three of us, and life has been kind to him. He looks the youngest by quite a way.
He hasn't changed a bit, has he?
No.
No, it's fantastic. But yeah, but Paul's a proper old school angler. He's a very nice guy. And what we thought we'd do is we'd have a couple of beers and interview him live on our Twitch stream. I need to work out how we can do that on YouTube as well, because I know YouTube's got Twitch is actually a gaming platform, and YouTube's now got a game streaming section on it, so we'll maybe have a work out how we can stream it on both at the same time, because I think you probably can. So I quite enjoyed that, Mark. I think we'll do it again, don't you?
Yeah, it was. I think the hardest part is getting the timing right for all three people to be, well, not in one place at the same time, but on call at the same time.
Yeah, you can go back and watch that. There's links on our Carpcast page and on my personal page, probably on yours as well, Mark. It's split into two parts. It did crash halfway through. But it's nearly 2 hours of interview, and we probably chatted for another hour or two afterwards as well, didn't we, once we switched everything off? So yeah, I really enjoyed that. I'll edit that interview up and put it out as the usual audio podcast on next week's show, I think. This week, as I said, we've got England international all-round nice guy, Mr. Mark Bartlett, giving us some match fishing tips. And yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation with him. Yeah, moving on, Mark. I'm sure you're all aware of our relationship with Carp Feed now. Absolutely fantastic news content, story content. They've got on their website, carpfeed.com, they've got lots of maps of day ticket lakes. So a few little extra edges. You go into a day ticket lake you haven't been before, you can have a look at the map on there. It's got all the hot spots and stuff. But yeah, Mark, have you seen anything?
It's on the net in association with carpfeed.com, so it's definitely true.
You seen anything, Mark?
Yeah, it's all true. I didn't notice the Monk's Pit Kipper has finally been on the bank after a good few months of evading capture.
Yeah, and a huge weight as well.
Yeah, late record 55. Which, yeah, it's probably the biggest fish in that lake now by around 10 pounds.
Wow, that's pretty big. What's the history of that fish, do you know, being a Monk's Pit member?
It's a Simo that was stocked as a single, I believe.
Right.
And it's just grown on eating whatever people throw at it. Probably quite a lot of it as well.
There's not too many Simos got much bigger than 55, have they? It has seemed to have been a ceiling in the UK. I know the ones that sort of hit that weight in Nash's, he bought a load of Simo about 15 years ago or something, and a few of them hit 50, but they died not too long afterwards.
Probably not tempting fate by saying that. The old porkies have lived quite a while.
Yeah,
I know what you're saying. I can't think of is the gear we fried in this Simo. That's up at 50 now, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not too sure the origins of that one. I know he's got a fish farm on site at Frining. Yeah,
That one was a Simo. It's got that look anyway, whether it is or not.
Fine
fish.
Not entirely sure where he got his original. Where he got his original fifth from. In Cart Feed, it says that Monk's Pit 55 pounder is Matt's 50th carp of the year. That seems like a lot of carp. Was he fish midweek when you were on, or have you seen him?
I don't recall ever seeing him there, so, but I fish, you know, when I get down there, is Sunday and Monday nights. You know, he might fish late week, he might fish weekend, and I'll never see him, so. But yeah, he's had a cracking season.
Yeah, his name's Matt Swan. He's says he's banked 48 fish in 25 nights, including 13 30s. It seems to fish two night sessions, so may say he's a weekend angler. Yeah, he's putting you to shame, Mark. Maybe I should do a show with him.
Not hard.
Does it say what bait he's on? Doesn't really say. What he's using. Have you noticed any particular bait doing the fish amongst this year?
Yeah, anything that's mainline that gets thrown in does really well, but it's seen a ridiculous amount of it, and you know, Mick the owner's got some sort of deal with mainline, so he gets quite a few of the lads at cheap.
Yeah.
There's quite, you know, as you're fishing any water, you do see, you know, certain trends that do catch a lot more fish.
It's
the case on Monk's.
Fair enough. Something else?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Something else I've seen on Cart Feed this week is, remember Captain Jack? How could we forget the infamous fish that has apparently beaten the British record? Well, apparently it's not beating the British record. Have you seen that, Mark?
I have, yes, and... Yeah, I'm as unconcerned as it was when it was potentially a British record, to be honest. But either way, have you also seen it's been caught since then as well?
I have seen that, yeah, and it's been caught since at the weight that his scales, after testing, said that it was the first time as well. So, the slight concerning thing here is... It was a brand new set of Reuben Heans, and they've been sent for testing. They have to go for calibrating if you're going to claim a record or whatever. You send your scales up. You just bought yourself a brand new set of Reubens, and you probably don't expect them to be wrong. But apparently, they were 8 ounce out. Nigel Ludbrook, who caught the fish, he's seeking a second opinion from manufacturer Reuben Heans before giving up his claim. So he seems pretty keen on claiming it.
Yeah, it's pretty much the gold standard of scales, or has been over the years, Reuben Heaton. So, you know, 8 ounces is kind of surprising, you know, especially the brand new scales. It's not like they've been used for 20 years and, you know, stretched out with lots and lots of big fish. So,
yeah, my Reubens are 20 years old, and I've tested them against brand new ones, and they're exactly the same. But if brand new ones can be 8 ounce out, I don't know, but there's a Norfolk calibration service found his scales to be weighing 8 ounce heavy. The only thing is with the bigger Reubens, mine only go up to 60, but the bigger ones, they have like 4 inch gaps, 4 ounce gaps, as opposed to the 1 ounce gaps on mine. Or was it 2 ounce on the 60 pounders? Can't remember, but they're, you know, the intervals are at 4 ounce anyway on those bigger ones. So I guess it's easier to read them wrong. But I don't know. I mean, how accurate can it be when it's weighing in 4 ounce divisions anyway? And it looks like it's going to be about. So if it's going to be 1 ounce under the record, isn't it? I think.
Something. Either way, the fellow has caught it, and he's caught, you know, a massive cap. But maybe everyone's going mad, and you know the fellow wants to know everything down to the nearest ounce of what he's actually caught. But imagine the old stories of when they used to catch these biggers from Redmire and, you know, put it on a push bike in a basket and take it up to the butchers to weigh it on the scales in there, or whatever they used to do.
Interestingly, the same test in place in Cambridgeshire were the people that tested Dean Fletcher's scales, which were also Reuben Heaton's, and they were found to be exactly spot on when tested by the Cambridgeshire trading standards. So interesting. It's not a good publicity for Reuben Heaton, I guess, for selling brand new scales which are 8 ounce out. But as usual, Cartfeeder done a fantastic job on the ins and outs. They answer pretty much everything you would want to know in a story, and even tell you how a record fish is claimed. So British Record Fish Committee Chairman Mike Halen told Cartfeed.com there's nothing stopping Nigel from seeking a second opinion and submitting a test certificate from another source. If Reuben say they want to test the scales, then they would be happy to accept their results. They've always been upfront and honest with us, so if they say the scales are 2 ounce light, they're 2 ounce light. So that's good that they will actually trust Reuben Heaton. They obviously respect their opinion. He says that official tests are now done in metric, so a calculation error with the conversion to imperial could have occurred. Reuben Heaton confirmed he was expecting the scales would issue a certificate of conformity. The company says its scales leave the factory with a tolerance of plus or minus one division. In this case, it would be 4 ounce. So basically saying it should only ever be 4 ounce either way as an absolute maximum. Captain Jack was again caught 16th for the 11th by Dave Smedley at 67.4, and there is a picture. So seems like a friendly one, doesn't it? When we on there?
Yeah, that's my favourite type of big fish. Stupid ones. No, get it booked up.
I'm pretty sure it is booked now.
You know, I know you want to catch it just to wind people up. I'll give you so much abuse online if you do, just to stir everyone else up into a frenzy.
Yeah, thank you very much. Pow, pow, shots fired! Something else, Mark. Have you seen that two more famous old tackle shops have been bought by Angling Direct?
It's on the net. It must be true.
I have seen. Over your side of the hills, aren't they?
Yes, they are. One of them is an angling shop that's had a few owners over the years, formerly Trev's of Wilmslow. It's north. It's called Tackle Saver at the minute. Oh, well, the two venues in question are Northwest Angling Centre and Tackle Saver, both very good Northwest shops that I've frequented regularly. Tackle Saver, I believe, was formerly Trev's of Wilmslow. They've been acquired by Angling Direct. That seem to be, well, your company and Angling Direct just seem to be buying up all the shops.
Yeah, they're certainly on a march, and well, it's the way the trade is going. We've already covered this on a previous episode. Like I say, a good bit of competition is good for the consumer. And I'll give a little plug in for Fishing Republic here for anyone who's in the lookout for anything new. Keep an eye on the website of the Black Friday sales, because I'm not going to give anything away here, but there's going to be some cracking deals going down. Really, really good deals.
After doing our live Twitch stream, I can picture you sat lay back on your chair in your office wherever you do this recording, and I picture you leaning forward then, because you just got much clearer and louder in the mic. So
I'm actually picking my toenails, so I'm not putting the light on, so I want me to see exactly the bit I was getting.
Yeah, it definitely sounds better when you lean forward. Anyway, it's more background noise when you're at the back, or move the mic.
Is this better then?
Oh yeah, you sound all bassy and I can't think of any more adjectives without sounding a bit perverse. But yeah. So Northwest Angling Centre, that's in Wigan. I went there the other year delivering posters for the Northern Angling Show. Actually, I've got a new Northern Angling Show jingle.
You're going to play it?
Yeah.
The Cartcast, in association with the Northern Angling Show, the North's biggest fishing event at Event City Manchester, 24th and 25th of February. For early entry and the cheapest tickets, visit northernanglingshow.co.uk.
Yep, good old Sarah was doing that. Did I tell you Kevin Nash wants Sarah to do the, you know, when you ring up Nash and it's like, welcome to the home of Nash Tackle. He's asked Sarah to do the all the phone stuff for there. He likes Sarah's cheeky voice. I think she did it and then did it all posh, and he wants her to do it again in like kind of the cheeky northern voice.
So when I'm at work, I'm just going to be ringing Nash and hanging up just so I can hear her voice.
I'm sure you can pay her for her. You might get longer. The old phone line. But, yes.
Should do those sort of 0898 calls?
I'm not sure. I've got enough jingles here anyway, so it's all good.
Yeah, send them over.
Yeah, but the Angler Direct, yeah, they're buying everything up. We've spoke about this being good or bad for the trade. I assume they're doing it for buying power, but it could end up in a bit of a monopoly, do you not think?
Well, not really a monopoly when you've got Angling Direct and Fishing Republic.
Yeah, but if both of them own, like, all the shops...
then that would be a duopoly.
It would be, yeah, but imagine if they were friends. It's a good job we have a Monopolies and Mergers Commission in the UK to kind of stop price fixing and stuff, but at the minute, you know, competition is healthy, obviously, because it drives prices down as opposed to up... But you know, once you get all the shop, you know, the two main companies owning all the shops, if they just spoke to each other and went, listen, you don't discount that and I won't discount it, then it's worse for the customer and better for them, I would guess. But I'll tell you what has impressed me or opened my eyes is the turnover some of these big shops are doing. I know there was information about Foster's that was released. Was it like $500,000 a year, something like that at the time? I should know because Cartfeed has all of the info. Just on it now, I know the profit was $460,000. Wow. The revenue is $5.9 million at Foster's. Now it's obviously a big shop, but it isn't the biggest. You know, some of the mail order ones that are doing chunks, the likes of Eric's, amongst others, and Eric's is in the pipeline of being bought as well by one of these big companies. I think that's public knowledge these days, isn't it? The Fishing Republic, that's been going through. It was a spin a secret for about 4 months out, but I think most people seem to know now. 5.9 million a year, which is exactly $500,000 a month. Yeah, that's some turnover. That was Foster's then. Obviously, it's been bought for less than half of that. It's been bought for $450,000, Trevor Wilmslow, plus the value of the stock. Yeah, it's a lot of business. Not really much more to say on that, to be honest, but it's going to be interesting to see. Well, that pair of shops made... Wow. So those two shops together made 1.8 million. I don't know. So the pair of shops generated revenue, sorry, not profit, revenue 1.8 million. So yeah, it's about a third of what Foster's does on its own. But yeah, it's certainly ambitious, isn't it? What they're doing, all this takeover. I'm interested to see how it all pans out. I've got a new little business going down in the fishing world that I'll be able to release details of soon, Mark. Something that hasn't really been done in fishing before. And I've mentioned it to you, and I'm dying to be able to launch it, but I've got a load of meetings next week.
Yes, you were practically jizzing down the phone when you were telling me about it the other week.
So I know you're motivated just the way you were going on about it. But yeah, it's always good to be doing something first, like the first Cartfishing podcast. That was good.
Yes, it was. Still going strong with many, many, many thousands of downloads every week.
Yeah, there's still plenty in the tank.
Yes, I like what you did there.
Bloody good shot, sir, and plenty in the tank, sir.
Yes, I've been having fun with my soundboard this week. So, yes.
Simply lovely.
So, yeah, be expecting plenty of jingles. Moving on, Mark, have you seen anything else on the net?
Oh, we're going to move on to the Fox video that's just been released with Rob Hughes and Mozart.
Yes, because you ought to check that out. Do you know the only jingle that I don't seem to have on here? Oh, no, I have.
Worth a look.
Something that's definitely...
worth a look.
...is the video released today with Mozza and Rob Hughes. Have you just watched it?
I have. I could have paid a little bit more attention. I'm going to watch it again, but I did find it's very, very interesting. Confirmed one or two things that I thought, cause as I said to you earlier on, not so long back on Monk's Pit, I was doing my own experiments, although unfortunately I didn't have my own personal Rob Hughes to go down and die so I could see where the leads had landed. So I was using the white foam and seeing where it actually came up in relation to the marker float. And, you know, after a bit of trial and error, I was getting it actually, you know, quite spot on.
So for those who have not seen it yet, it's been shared on the official Carpcast fan page. Heapy Bob shared that this morning. Thank you very much, Mr. Heapy. It's the age-old question. We had a discussion a little while back. How far do you need to cast behind your marker to make sure that your bait is landing exactly where you think it is, number one. And two, making it even more accurate, if you're leading around with your braid rod, marker rod, then you find the spot, clip it up. Then what should you be clipping your mono, presumably mono rods to make sure it's landing in the same area. Now, as the conclusion we've come to a lot is there are so many variables in this that if you're not feeling your lead down, then how will you ever know if you're on the spot or not? And I can't stress enough. Somebody made a post the other day on one of the groups or something. They were talking about, would you rather, like, who do you think knows more about fishing? The guy that's been fishing recreationally a couple of nights a week for 25 years, or some, you know, keno fishing 4 or 5 nights a week, it's only been fishing a few years, a handful of years. And the first comment underneath was, I know guys that have been fishing 25 years and still don't feel a letdown, which I thought was a really good comment, because just because you've been fishing forever doesn't mean you've been doing it in the best possible way. And
is a perfect comment, because my wife has been driving for 20 years and she still scares the shit out of me.
Oh dear.
Pew pew, shots fired.
Yeah, okay. Good job she doesn't listen to this, I guess. But yeah,
she's not in now as well.
Yes. So I thought that was a very valid point, because I say, when I've done tuitions and fishing with people, the amount of good anglers I've seen that don't feel a letdown is untrue. Now, they're still a good angler. They've obviously worked out a way to get bites without necessarily being that accurate on the bottom. And what I did notice, I mean, I'm not going to name who it is, but I fished next to a guy that was fishing at long range and wasn't feeling the lead down at all, but he caught and I didn't, and I was like, obviously there must be a reason why what he does still works for him, and he's just found a way where he doesn't really need to know if he's fishing on weed or whatever, because he was using a rig that didn't really matter where it landed, it was still fishing. And so he's just kind of found a way to, to be presented wherever he sort of lands. I guess if you do a lot of long range fishing, it's not always easy to feel a let down at long range anyway. So he's just developed a method that works for him. But I don't recommend that. You know, I recommend that you know what you're fishing on. What's the point in finding spots? And as we know, there are spots within spots. The more accurate you are, there's a reason why there are spots on the bottom of a lake. Yes, you can chuck it around. Yes, you can fish a chod rig and be fishing pretty much anywhere. But I like to know why something happens, as opposed to just, you know, oh, well, I caught a fish one day and I didn't the next day. I want to know why we caught that one day and why we didn't the next day, because there are reasons. Maybe you weren't on fish, maybe you weren't on the spot that they're feeding on. But the reason why there are spots on the bottom of lake is because quite often the fish make them, and they make them by feeding on something at a certain time of year, or because other food's in the area, or because the angler creates an area, or because it's a hot spot in a swim that, you know, lots of people fish. So there's always a food source. There could be a lot of different reasons, but I like to know I'm on spots, first of all. And I've definitely caught more fish fine-tuning spots and finding the spots within the spots and stuff. So accuracy, I think, is important, and it's something that all the top, you know, 1% or 5% anglers that I know, it's something they all pay attention to. And this video that Rob made was excellent. I think they could have done a lot more, and Moz has actually been engaging in the chat on our page this morning. This is very new, it's all come out today, and Moz has been in there, and I've questioned Moz on a couple of things, and he said I don't know the answer. Now, I've, as we spoke at length in one of the earlier podcasts, I've gone into this at length over the years, as you just said you did last week, Mark. You were you know, seeing how far you had to cast behind a marker to make sure that your foam on your hook pops up right by the marker. And what was the conclusion you came to?
Oh, the proper noddy. That was pretty much the conclusion. Although what I was doing, I've got braid on my fishing reels as well as my marker rod, so, you know, my marker rod is clipped up, and I was just clipping the fishing rods at exactly the same point. And it was, I don't know, I think it was about 14 wraps of spot I was fishing in 16 foot of water, and I was surprised how far behind the float the lead is actually landing. And then I come to put a bit of bait out with a spot, you know, that's like a full wrap short. Get it spot on. Now, after a lot of fishing where I've just not bothered with a marker float, I've led it around, I found a spot, I've led it around a bit more after clipping up, thought, yep, that'll do. And then I've clipped a spotter out up at the same distance. So, in all likelihood, I'm fishing well short of the bait that I'm spommed out.
Yeah, you're spomming a rod length behind. That was exactly the conclusions I came to after many years. But when I was fishing in Croatia earlier in the year, and I was fishing, my fishing rods were at 27 wraps. And exactly the same thing. I had to clip the spot up because it was braid. I had to clip the spot up a rod length shorter to make sure that it was over the spot. And then we had this debate, didn't we? And there was a lad asked a question on the Carpcast page. Then he went to a lot of other top anglers, asked them the same questions, and everybody said something different for a start. And a lot of them were just guessing. None of them had actually tested it. I couldn't understand why experienced anglers writing in magazines and producing videos and DVDs and stuff don't know one of the most basic things and just guess at it. Go, oh, well, I just do this and it works for me. Well, does it work for you? You're just catching because you're a rod. If I'm catching because I'm fishing a rod length off the bait, I want to know I'm catching because I'm fishing a rod length off the bait and not on the bait. Like, if I'm catching because I'm fishing off bang on the bait, but I've got another rod that's two rod lengths off and I'd happen to pick a bigger fish up on that rod, I don't want to be sat there thinking, oh, well, they're all just feeding on the bait. I want to know that I caught the big one because I was actually two rod lengths off the bait. Do you know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? It's like, yeah. Just because you catch doesn't mean you know why you caught. Like I say, if you are in the habit of always baiting up a rod length away from where you're actually putting your hook baits, but you catch a fish, I want to know that I was catching a rod length off the bait. And would I have caught more fishing on the bait? Would I have caught, or, you know, am I picking bigger fish up that way? Am I picking the stragglers up? Like, I just want to know what I'm doing for a start. At least I can then make the decision of I want to fish off it or I want to fish on it or whatever. But so many people, and I'm talking about good anglers, good, you know, anglers that catch fish that write in magazines, half of them don't know if they're fishing on it or not. And this, to me, seems like one of the most basic things in fishing. And if we're spread baiting because we deliberately want the fish searching and moving around, then great, but at least know you're doing it, you know. So, yep, this video absolutely concluded what I've already, you know, found out for myself. But it was a very, it was one example. It was an example of fishing at 13 wraps in 10 foot of water. And the conclusion was, in 10 foot of water, if you put, if you're letting around with a braid rod and you find the spot, you pull, tighten the line, wrap it out so you know it's exactly whatever it was. In this case, it was 13.5 wraps. You can, in 10 foot of water, you can wrap your normal rod to the same distance, 13.5, because of the stretch in the line, and then the depth of 10 foot, which means it's got, you know, a couple of seconds dropping through the water, which sorts the stretch out as it's landing. It does actually land pretty close to your marker. But if you weren't wrapping, if you were just doing it by sight, it's exactly what you said, Mark. Mozza couldn't believe it on his video. He's actually said in the thread, it's his best 2 days fishing without fishing to catch fish that he's ever had. It was an eye-opener. And this is a point somebody's experienced as Mozza didn't know for sure what was going on, where he's putting his bait. Now, it turns out Mozza's extremely accurate. Once he knew what he was doing and the rods were clipped up right, he was landing. What they did, they laid a 1.2 metre square box out on the bottom with marker poles, red and white marker poles, put the marker float in the middle. But even Mozza didn't know that you need to land almost a rod length. Even at that 14 wraps, you're landing nearly a rod length behind your marker float for it to swing back and drop down right next to it. And if you're fishing shallower water where the bounce back hasn't got enough time to get back, or if you're fishing 25 wraps plus, it was, their experience was showing that there was about 10% stretch in mono. And they also found that if they were using fluorocarbon, they had to add distance onto the normal rods because the bounce back was more. Obviously there's less stretch in fluorocarbon, which would be the same for braid. So all in all, watch the video, it's on the Fox YouTube page. It's a fantastic video and I really look forward to, I really hope they do more of the same. I hope they don't think they've just covered it now, because straight away there was a load of questions that I found from it, and I asked Mozza, who made this video, I asked him and he didn't know the answers to these questions. So they need to do more, and I really hope they do. I tried ringing Rob today, actually he didn't answer. I missed him yesterday and he's missed me today. But I think I know the answers because I've done it myself, but even Mozza, who's just spent 2 days making that video, still couldn't answer the question of, okay, how would you set your rods up fishing 25 wraps with mono? He's like, I honestly couldn't tell you. Excuse me. Which tells you that, there's quite a few variables, but it can be worked out. So,
yeah. After watching that video, when you've coughed up all your Ebola, after watching that video, and you've got all digested all that information, did you think back to a particular session or a time where you now think, I fished that completely wrong?
No, because I always feel the lead. I've done for the last sort of 20 years, so
I'm always feeling the lead as well. I'm on about you've baited up a rod length behind or something like that.
I think I probably put the bait in the wrong spot a few times.
I know I have.
But I usually have a marker out there. It's only this year, really, I've started not using a marker float and just using the wraps. And that's where, this debate has come from with how far are we wrapping in relation to... We know how far the spot is because we're led around with a braid rod. We find the spot, so we know where that is exactly, and then we clip it up. Clip it up, wrap it out, and then I also the fact that I've already had this discussion earlier on this year tells you that I'm thinking about it all the time. I worked out that you had to put, if you remember in that discussion, in my Croatia Lakes discussion, I said you need to put the spom shorter than your rods, and nobody agreed with me. That lad that then didn't, he didn't take my word for it. He went and asked a load of other anglers that all gave different answers tells you that none of them have actually thought about it in great depth either. They all just said they usually just clip them all up to the same, in which case your bait is a rod length behind. As I mean, it's nearly a rod length behind at 14 wraps. How far behind is it more than that? And I remember in a couple of the very early carp casts when we I was speaking about fishing Dead Man's, because on Dead Man's Lake it's quite long range, most of it's 80 to 100 yards, and but then you can walk round the other side to bait up, so you can catapult, it's catapult range from the far side. So you'd fish it like say 80, 90 yards, and I remember saying once before, Roger was stood round the other side, like baiting his rods. He was in the next swim, and I do everything by feel. I will never put my rod out. You know, I'll put the marker rod out. This is before wrap sticks. I would put the marker rod out, and then I would lead with my actual fishing rod with just a lead on and no rig. Until I knew that I was actually on whatever the spot was, gravel, silt, whatever it was, but I would know by feel, and I'd keep doing it until it was where it was. And then I remember actually casting the rig out and Roger saying, do you know how far past your marker that is? And I was like, well, it only looks like 6 foot behind the marker from where I was stood on my bank. And he's like, it's two rod lengths past. And now I know it was on the right spot because I was feeling it, you know, it was the same bumper, it was, you know, whatever, where the gravel just started. Like, you're in silt, and then you pull back to the edge of the gravel, you'd pull your marker to that exact point, pop it up, and then I'd have a lead until, you know, if I pointed the rod forward slightly, it landed in silt, and if I kept the rod a bit more vertical, I felt the gravel bump. And then I clip it up, and then I put my rig on, and I cast it there. And obviously Roger was like, do you know how far behind your marker that's landing? I was like, no, it looks about 6 foot from here. And he's like, it's two rod lengths. But you couldn't, again, because of the angle of you being stood looking at a marker float 80 yards into the lake, it's impossible to tell unless you've got a side-on view of it, which obviously you never have when you're casting. But just goes to show. But I would have been baiting accurately then, because I was walking around the other side and catapulting it to the marker. I think I'd probably been closer, but I'd already worked out that if you're using braid on your spod, braid on your marker float, then you need to be short of whatever your about a rod length short of whatever your fishing rods are with the bait. And not one, if you remember, that lad posted all the results from all the other people he'd asked, not one of them agreed with me, and that's exactly what it is. They're all, you know, and these are all good, competent anglers, but they've just never done the test.
Yeah, what we need now is different tests at different distances, in different depths, and a sliding graph.
Exactly what we need, and I really hope Rob does this, because like I say, Moz has just done this test and he still couldn't answer my question of, okay, if you're going twice the distance in shallower water, what would you be clipping up at? And he couldn't answer. So they need to do it. They need to do one at 25 wraps, and they need to do some in shallower water where we don't get the spring back, because that lake that I'm fishing in Croatia a lot next year on the fishing trips, I'm going to be there quite a bit. The reason why I was asking that question is because it's 5-6 foot deep. You literally, as soon as the lead hits the water, you get a bump, and if you're not hitting the clip really well, you don't get any bump at all because it's too shallow. You've got to hit the clip right to get a bump in the first place. So most of it's like 5 foot, and it's long range, sort of 30 wraps. That's why I was asking that question, because obviously I fished like that last year, well, last summer, and I know where I needed to be. And I also blanked for the first 24 hours. It was only when I sussed it out and started spomming accurately that I started getting the bites, when the spom was landing right over the bait, and we were getting the bites pretty instantly. So, yes, please, Rob, some long range stuff. I mean, the fact that the stretch made a difference at 13 wraps, and I actually never thought that it would make any sort of difference at that depth, at that distance. But talking about noticing things and depth markers and stuff like that, something else that I saw on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Another story on carpfeed.com, twitching depth marker leads to 340s and a 30 at Darrenth. Not heard much about Darrenth in recent years. Leon Bartrop mentioned on his interview a few weeks back that it's back to its former glory, really. A lot of the fish they put in years ago are big again. And this guy who's actually a pro golfer, his name is Bill Hodkin. He caught mirrors of 46, 44, 40 and a 33 on a three-night session. And the reason why he went in that swim is there's a depth marker. You know, those like white sticks you get with the markers on. They have them in rivers a lot, don't they? Especially
yeah,
near
yeah,
roads.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, he noticed that the white post was twitching. It's like out in the lake, 95 yards out or something, and he could see there was fish there because it was rocking. So the post swings when fish rub against it, he says, and it started going while I was setting up. So he placed a single rod in that area. 8:30 that night, the post rod was away and he had a 44-pound mirror and proceeded to catch all the rest off that spot. Have you ever done that, Mark? Have you ever left a permanent marker out in the swim?
I have done. This is going back a long time on Aiken when we used to be able to use boats. But because obviously I wasn't the only one using boats over there, I never left the marker on the actual spot. It was about 30 yards to the side of it, but out when I was out of my boat, if I lined my marker up with you know, certain trees on the banks behind it and also at the side of me, I know I'd be over my spot.
Yeah, we when I was fishing Fendrayon many years ago, that's a boating lake, and what everybody did on there, you got these 5 foot canes from like B&Q or somewhere, and you would tape them together to make a 10 foot one, and you'd use it as a prodding stick, and then when you found the spot that you wanted, you just stuck it into the bottom and left it there. You'd leave it in for your session. We used to have multiples of them, so you could see, like, we've got four rods out, you could see all the four rods. It's really good actually seeing exactly where they are in kind of like a fan with the canes. And what you'd find if you're on fish, the post would rock. You can, I don't think it bothers the fish in the slightest, quite the opposite actually. I think it's like a feature, they rub up on it when they're feeding. You know, they knock it anyway. Nash do like a carbon version of the equivalent thing now. They do like a prodding stick. I don't know if you've seen them or got them in the shop or anything, Mark.
No, I have seen them. I know what you mean, but it's not something that we've actually got in at the moment.
They're brilliant, they are, because they've got like holes in the bottom. What you find with water pressure, if you're prodding around in 8, 10, 12 foot or whatever, because you could just keep taping those canes up. It's a really cheap way of doing it, but it gets hard moving them around and feeling the bottom once you start getting 10 foot plus. But obviously those carbon poles at Nash did, they've got like holes in the bottom which lets the water go through them as you're moving them around, and you've got a couple of different ends you can screw on, and one for silt, like a flatter end, and like a really sort of sharp proddy end for gravel and stuff. And you kind of feel everything through the carbon pole, and then obviously you can just ram it in. Now, some lakes don't like you leaving them in the water, plus they're about 60 quid each, so if they do happen to fall over and sink, which has happened to me, yeah, Kevin, one thing I would like with those is you've got the holes in the top of them, which obviously lets the air through as you're moving them around on the bottom, but the red float bit that's right at the top, can you not just seal that and make an air capsule so they don't sink? Because I've probably lost four of them over the years. I think they've gone over in the night or in wind or something and just sunk. But anyway, yeah, they are great. And the fish absolutely love them. I remember a session on Church Lake about 10 years ago, probably when these poles first came out. It was definitely when Nash released the... remember that first throwing stick that they did? Was it green? It had the loading bit in the bottom. I forget what they were called now. The very first... throwing stick Nash did about 10 years ago. I remember them bringing a couple up to the church for me to test out. I had a rod in the middle of the lake between the islands with one of those poles in marking the spot, and I was feeding like little and often with the throwing stick and single baits, just because I was testing this throwing stick all session basically. Anyway, I remember starting to see the post rock, and it was rocking really good, like there's definitely fish on it. Anyway, I ended up having about 6 fish off that spot. It was an epic session, I think, that one. But yeah, the post was just banging. And obviously, when it's flat calm in the mornings at first light, you can just see it because it's just making rings around the pole where it's rocking it on the surface. But yeah, I quite like that. And I don't think it spooks the fish at all. leaving the pole or a cane in the water. Don't think it bothers them in the slightest. Been chatting a little bit, Mark. Now, you got anything else you want to say?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, but I am looking forward to hearing what Mark Bartlett has to say.
Then it's probably a good time to get him in. Feels like I'm in love. Just like the first time I met you. I'd like to welcome to the Carpcast a man with more decoration, more medals than anyone outside of the army, I think, certainly in fishing. This guy has been the European champion, British team champion and British carp champion for various matches. Would you please welcome to the Carpcast an expert, Mr. Mark Bartlett. How are we doing, pal?
Yeah, very well, very well. Thank you, Jamie. Good morning.
I still feel like I got all that wrong. do you need to correct me on anything?
It's all good.
So last year, all in one year, you were champions with England.
World Championships. And then me, Tom Maker and Billy Flowers won the European Championships. And then me and Kev, just before we won the World Championships, me and Kev won. Me and Kev won the British Championships at the back of last year as well, and again this year.
So I've seen some people say out there that, you know, there's a lot of luck in match fishing. That doesn't sound like luck to me. you can't be coming first out in the draw and getting the best swim every single time, can you?
With the way carp naturally behave, and the one thing that in carp match fishing that's different to normal match fishing is obviously we're just targeting one species, and you know they are a nomadic species, and if you can get on an absolute hat full of fish, then happy days. But it's, you know, that's not life, that's not real time fishing all the time.
So let's get straight into this then, on the match side of it. So if you don't draw a favourable swim, are you still confident you've got a good chance of getting in the top three or whatever you need to be to qualify or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, before all of that, because I fish with Kev, and me and Kev went to school together. We fished all our lives together. So we use the competitions as almost like a guarantee that we'll spend some time fishing together, because my life's busy, Kev's life's busy, we've both got kids, all of that stuff. So we use it as like a nailed on, we're going fishing together. And so what we do is we sit down and we look at the venues and we say, right, we want to fish there because we like that lake. And if we qualify, then we go through to that lake and we like that lake. And that's literally what we do. We don't,
You're not just going to go and win. It's silent.
I mean, there's some venues in the past that we fished that we wouldn't necessarily fish if we were just going pleasure fishing. But you know that you can go there, you can have a good bit of carnage. You're going to catch an absolute boatload of carp. But when we get the choice, we just literally. And anybody that's seen us fish, it could be in the thick of the moment, and one of us will probably be sitting there cranking the barbecue up. and that's what it's like. You know, we just go fishing together. And because we're such a solid pair, we can fish second to none. Like, you know, however hectic it is, one of us could stand at the front of that swim and catch all those fish. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. So, we're proper chilled out with it all.
Wow.
Which is the way to go.
So what about sleep in the 48-hour session? If it's, you know, if somebody else is catching it, do you take your foot off the gas if your swim's hammering it and no one else is closed? Do you make sure you get some sleep, or do you keep working all the time? Or what about a situation where, you know, you're neck and neck with maybe two or three other swims and it is literally volume? Do you have no sleep at all? Or how does that side of it work?
Yeah, I mean, we're still proper chilled out, because what we do is we're not, if you've got an out-the-bag draw, you've gotten out by the back door, and it, you know, your hands, there's nothing you can do about it. So once you get to your swim, it's like, right, what are we going to do to catch the most fish out of this peg? We can't think of everybody else because they're different circumstances. We can't control that. It's, you know, it's well out of your hands. So yeah, if we feel like we just need to be patient, we still be patient. If we're on a, you know, don't get me wrong, if we're on an absolute load of fish, we'll stand. It's easy catching fish. You know what it's like. It's sort of like eat, sleep, rave, repeat. And I mean, for a pro like me and Kev, we set a world record on Drayton.
Yeah.
And we caught over a ton of carp in a 48-hour match on there.
Yeah.
And we blanked for 26 hours of that match.
Really?
We caught 223 fish. We actually, to be fair, we actually got a proper roasting because we were supposed to be, it was in the England trials when Pete and Ian ran it, and we were supposed to be up all night catching. And me and Kev, we know when it's going to happen and we know when it's not going to happen. And we knew that it wasn't going to happen. So we got into bed and just, we cooked a steak. We cooked a steak and we went to sleep. But what it did is it, a few other people went to sleep as well then, which had this sort of, you know, it wasn't the right effect for the trials. I mean, it was only short lived before Pete and Ian put a stop to it all. But we knew that it wasn't happening. But in the daytime when it was happening, we were stood there and we caught, you know, we caught 50 fish each in 5 hours each day. And that was, you know, and that was that. But it's, yeah, it's just horses for, like, you just don't know. Like, it's only your experience that will ever tell you when it's, you know, when it's going to happen, when it's going to not happen. It's the same as all the decent anglers. They're never, it's nothing they've got. It's not anything, any bait wise. It's not any tackle. It's just watercraft, and that's all that'll ever catch you the fish.
Yeah, we'll go deeper into tactics shortly. I've got a lot of stuff to pick your brains about, but I'm quite interested, having known that Pete and Ian, because they are both from Blackpool, which is where I'm from, and I've come into contact with them on Wire Side up here. Are they the Alex Ferguson, you know, kicking the trainer in people's faces when they've had a bad match? I imagine them being pretty tough.
You know, one, they're Northern. I mean, you know, Rob Hughes is the manager of the team now. And if you take both of them over the years, they've got a job to do. They can't be, you know, I'm very good friends with Rob Hughes.
Yeah.
But he can't be my friend whilst he's running that team. But he, you know, because the buck stops with him. So he's got a job to do. And that's that.
You know, I was joking about Pete and Ian. I don't expect to say anything about them, but I know they were quite tough as bailiffs up on Wireside. So, you know, I was just picturing the Alex Ferguson incident where he's thrown the or kicked the football boot at David Beckham's eye, you know, in a rage. But he was known for that at the end. But I never really imagined that any manager, Rob Hughes or Pete and Ian or anyone, I'm being a bit flippant, but I never imagined any of them that actually get upset, stroke, you know, extremely passionate about fishing. But I'm guessing it's the same. There's pressure on them.
Let me tell you now, Rob Hughes is probably the most passionate bloke I know when it comes to, you know, when it comes to sort of wearing his country badge. I've seen it raw on the bank when it's, you know, when it's going off, good and bad. And yeah, like, you know, yeah, there's no messing about with Rob. As you know, as far as the manager's concerned, you know, he's got a job to do, and he's very professional and stern with it.
Oh, interesting. So he's probably the Alex Ferguson, I guess.
He's a bloody good manager.
Excellent. We spoke to Rob about this year's World Championship with England. It didn't go great. He admitted to trying a tactic for the grass carp sort of early on that didn't really work. And did that just put you 24 hours behind, do you think? Or would you have done it differently if you were the manager?
No, like we sit down and we sort of sort out what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. But it's like if you go to a lake and you could rock up at a busy day ticket lake, and if you fish the same as everybody else, you'll catch the same as everybody else. You know, you might catch nothing, you might catch one or two, and you might do all right if the lake's fishing well. But you'll never really, you know, you'll never really run away with it. Whereas if you do your own thing and you know, you've got to take a gamble. Nothing's ever been, you know, no one's ever been successful from not taking a gamble from time to time. And, you know, that's what we did take. If it had paid off, we'd have absolutely walked the match. It didn't. So, you know, we were on the back foot a little bit and we recovered a little bit. But, you know, these nations, they're tough. They're really good anglers now. We've spent the last couple of decades absolutely pumping everything we know down their throats. And then they're using that against us with what they know. But we've got to go do it in their backyard. And it's tough. You know, it is tough to do it.
Yeah, I've noticed. I spent quite a bit of time in Croatia and Slovenia this last couple of years, and I met a few of their national team as well. They were coming down the lakes, and just the way their lakes are set up, you know, big gravel pits, open water, not a lot of weed, long casting, like straight away, they're doing this for their normal fishing every day. Now, as you know, British lakes tend to be smaller. It's only in recent years they're getting more heavily stocked, whereas the lakes seem to be just natural match waters. Like their run of the mill lake is kind of geared up as a match water almost, with the, you know, the stocking levels and the styles of fishing, and, you know, they're casting much further than, you know, there aren't that many UK anglers that need to cast 100 metres, you know, 120 yards on every time they go fishing. It's rare. I fished for 15 years before bought any rods that were capable of casting more than 80 or 90 yards. Do you think that's one of the reasons that, like, their waters are just geared up for it a little bit more?
Their waters are... they are what they are, and our waters are completely, you know, they're the other end of the spectrum. And not only that, our fish are completely conditioned to the way that we fish, whereas their fish, a lot of the time, you know, they, like some of the lakes that we fish over there, they take the fish to eat them. You know, they've always got a new supply of fish, whereas our fish just get caught time and time again and get released.
Yeah, so they're not getting hammered, their fish. They're
yeah, no, you know, not all of them, because some of them, you know, like the likes of Shumba and places like that, they obviously catch and release. It's a tough old game, and you've got to have it all nailed on, and everything's got to fall into place at the right time for you to be, and the way the sections work as well. You could catch, someone else could catch a fish and put you up ahead without you actually catching a fish, and vice versa. It can also bring you down. And where so many countries are fishing now, we've also got split sections. So you might not even be able to beat the people you want to beat in your section to take points off of them, because they're in a different section. So it is too much for me. Rob and a few of the others, like Rob, Harry, and a few of the others, and Kev, they understand the point system and everything really well. I don't. I just go fishing.
Yeah, the thing I didn't like about it all when Rob told me was how obviously, like, as a manager, if you're managing a football team and their side's got a really fast, I don't know, left winger, you know, you would make sure you would pick somebody to counteract him and put him on your right winger, who might not be as good as the guy you normally pick, but this guy's a bit faster, and you know, so you can adjust it. Whereas he told me with the match that you can't pick which ones of your team go in which section. So if you're in a real long casting section, you can't just go, right, I'm going to put my two longest casters in there, because they, you know, the Croatians next door have got a really big caster in that section. I need to put my biggest caster next to it. Like, he's saying he's not allowed to do that. Like, you can't pick who goes in what sections. Is that right?
No. You submit your team, and then it's literally, they do a draw, and it's, it could be like Billy and Jamie in section A, Carl and Harry in section B, and so on and so forth. So if you've got an island at 50 yards or whatever, then you don't need someone with a 6-pound line and a 50-pound leader in there. But, you know, that's fishing. We should all, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that everybody should be level, and, you know, like, and be, all the pairs should be of the same ability, sort of thing.
Yeah, I get that. But, you know, you've got a freak of nature. Rob was telling me about that 19-year-old lad that cast 200 metres, built like a brick outhouse. I forget where he was from now.
Yeah, I think he was Lithuanian, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, that's a freak of nature. Everybody's not going to be like that guy, are they?
They're proper blade shifters. I got a photo of a couple of the other Lithuanians, and they're two brothers, and they are Lithuanian arm wrestling champions, and my eyes are level with their nipples, like that, if I stand next to them. They're absolute mountains. I reckon the bloke's forearm is as thick as my thighs. It's ridiculous. Yeah, they're huge.
Yeah. Well, before we move off the European and world stage, what sort of countries, you know, have you had a chance to visit a few nice places, travelling, fishing, have you anywhere in particular that stands out?
Yeah, I mean, they're all lovely. They're lovely, and they're also so similar to over here, because we literally either jump on a plane or drive, and you go and sit and stare at a lake for a week and then drive straight home because you're knackered.
Yeah.
So yeah, we don't get a lot of time to go sort of gallivanting and sightseeing, but they're all lovely countries, obviously weather permitting. I liked Italy's probably like one of my favorites. I fished in Romania quite a lot. I quite like that country. I like them all for different reasons, but yeah, they're all good countries. They're all always hosted well. The reception that you get from everybody's always really good, and you know, they all sort of, we get on really well with a lot of the teams as well. I've got a lot of, you know, I've made a lot of new mates out of it all now.
Did you match fish before you fished for carp? Were you sort of course match fishing?
I've just always gone fishing, and I think it's the same for many of the good anglers in the country. The ones that are that always catch and always do well is because they just fish for, you know, they just fish throughout the year for given the right weather and sort of time of year, they fish for the right fish. I started off match fishing. Me and Kev used to fish in the school matches against each other. We set that up at school with a lot of our mates. My other mate that I was, because I used to be like British junior champion like way back in the day.
Yeah.
When I still had a squeaky voice. We were all at the same school. He now runs the tackle shop on my fishery. It's all really good. And like, I've just enjoyed my fishing right the way through my life. Everyone says, like, you know, with like sort of sponsorship deals and stuff like that, I'm just going off the subject a little bit, but you know, they think it's great, oh, you got these sponsorships and this, that and the other, but you can't, you know, you've still got a roof to put over your head and all of that sort of stuff. So the only thing you can ever guarantee anybody is that if you've got 5 days, then yeah, you could go to France for a week or wherever and go and sit there and catch a unit. If you've got 3 days, you could go and sort of try and plumb up trying to catch a unit over in this country, you know, maybe go to like Lynch Hill, Bluebell, Manor, places like that. If you've got 48 hours or just, you know, 36 hours, then yeah, you're going to go to Brasenose and somewhere up Linear where you can get on a few fish. If you've got 5 hours, then I'm going to go and sit on a seat box and probably go like, you know, feed a fish in or something like that. And if I've got 5 minutes, I'm probably going to have to catch one off the top walking up the car park at my lake after work.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that is fishing. It's what you make of it. If you can always find an excuse not to go, but you can, if you look in the right places, you can always find time to go and catch fish in the time that you've got. It might not be necessarily like the £40 fish from your syndicate water that you want to catch, but it's, you know, it's just about getting that fix. And I listened to Carl's one last week where he said about just getting a fix going trout fishing, and that is fishing. A lot of the good anglers, they're just anglers, and all right, yeah, they prefer fishing for carp, but they're also clued up enough not to, you know, they're not going to go and sit there when it's, the pressure's through the roof, it's absolutely freezing, and they know that they're pretty much not going to get a bite, or they'll go somewhere where they know they're going to get a bite.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of carp anglers or carp only anglers that miss out on everything else, you know, on the other forms of fishing. I started carp angling because I was enjoying fishing for a few years and then ended up catching, you know, or losing the odd big carp, and that sort of gave you the buzz to catch bigger fish. But it's no coincidence that all the best anglers out there all are fish for multi-species. They all started off fishing canals, rivers, you know, and just understanding that's got to help with watercraft sort of long term, must help you with your match fishing now. I mean, what watercraft, do you think it can be taught, or do you think you literally have to just go fishing, you know, or vary your fishing to be able to sort of understand the whole picture?
Yeah, I don't think you can actually teach it. And I think this is probably single-handedly the biggest problem in angling nowadays is, and it's, you know, it's not, you can't say like, oh, you know, oh, they haven't, you know, they haven't got a clue or anything like that, because they generally love fishing. They're getting into fishing, and it'll only take them, you know, take them time to learn the watercraft. Yeah, you can explain it, and you can explain sort of what things you're looking for, but only yourself will ever know. It's like, it's almost like trying to ride a bike, isn't it? You know, and it's just so hard to explain, but yet in your mind it's so easy to understand because you've spent, and you've got that experience and you've learned it. So you just think, oh, why does no one else understand that, when that's not the case?
Yeah, that's the thing with anything. Once you understand something fully because of experience, which is usually the key thing here, is the experience. Once you understand something fully, it just seems so obvious and logical, and it's like, why doesn't everyone else get it? Because it's pretty straightforward. But I'm guessing if you haven't, you know, sometimes it's harder trying to learn something, you know, from somebody else than actually just doing it. I don't know. The other thing with the people getting into carp fishing is exciting, and, you know, it's quite high tech, it's quite cool these days, and it's very hard to go back to sitting, you know. I think of some of the days when I was a kid, sitting on little uncomfortable seat boxes with a dripping brolly on me, getting wet and uncomfortable. It's really hard to go back to that once you've been a carp angler, I think, because it was sort of tougher then, you know. I'm glad I had the background, but I don't go as much. You know, so
yeah, I mean, yeah, the kids nowadays, like, carp fishing is cool, and it is, you know, it's a trendy thing to do, which is brilliant, you know, for our sport and what we all love doing. You know that it's gonna, you know, it's gonna carry on, and sort of everybody that's worked for what we've got in the sport and in the trade and everything is, you know, it's really good. Another thing that I would say is, I was chatting to Chris Blunt the other day. So if there's any juniors listening, or any blokes that have got kids that they want to get into carp fishing and do, maybe touch doing a few matches, is that Chris Blunt at Linear Fisheries, they've taken over the BYCAC, the British Young Carpers Championships.
Yeah.
And they're holding the events all at Linear throughout the year. And yeah, I know that Chris has got some big plans. Is actually, I think, for the lads that win, or whoever wins, there's a chance for them to go and represent a junior England thing abroad, over in the Czech Republic. But yeah, so Chris is buzzing. He's absolutely, you know, he can't wait to sort of do something for the kids again.
It's a didn't that actually stop for a year or two, the British Young Carpers? Did it get canned and then he's took it over, or?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, so Chris is taking it upon himself to sort it out again, which is brilliant. I'm going to try and like go up and do some of the events with him, just, you know, even if it's just walking around and go and see the lads fishing. But yeah, so that's really cool. So if anyone is listening that, you know, that wants to get into, I think the adults can sit with them as well, so they can guide them through the match or whatever.
You may have heard, if you've listened to the last show or two, but I don't know how I'm going to do it yet, but I want to do something to be helping sort of youth getting into fishing for a number of reasons, you know, whether it be carp fishing, whether it be course fishing, whatever, just into fishing generally, with the Northern Angling Show, we've already been working with Get Hooked on Fishing, and Rob's had some campaigns where there's a spring into fishing and stuff from the Angling Trust. But I don't really know how or what to set up yet. We're looking at a couple of things with some companies, and but it's really keen, I think, to encourage the youth coming in. So I'm glad Chris is doing that up there. And, you know, when you speak to him, anything we can do to help promote that, get him to get in touch, send us press releases, whatever, because I think it's important. There's not enough youth coming into fishing at the minute. The entry level to get into fishing is quite high because most people are coming into carp fishing. And as you know, syndicates are expensive. There's less and less club waters. They're getting taken over by syndicates. The entry level of equipment is expensive for carp fishing. And you can start fishing very easily and cheaply, like I did with a borrowed rod off my granddad and, you know, some old line and a reel and, you know, a few quid in the local tackle shop, and you can be fishing on, you know, for perch or roach or something. It doesn't have to be all about carp. And anything we can do, let Chris know when you speak to him. I'd be happy to promote that. Talking of linear, it's maggot time. It's that time of year. Have you been out on any of the sort of maggot trips yet? Or have they banned them on there now, on linear?
Most places have banned them now. You've got to go to somewhere that hasn't banned them. But to be fair, even with the maggot ban, when maggots are just so effective that when you start using them, they are, if you're sort of like the only one, or there's only a couple of you using them on the lake, they're really effective. When it's the same as everything else, if everybody's using the same bait, then it loses its edge a little bit. So with them being banned, with the other baits just being allowed, boilies, corn, pellets, hemp, that sort of thing. You're still in with a shout because you know that everybody else isn't using them, so you can fish, you can just carry on fishing normally. It's only when someone starts putting in like maggots, casters or worms, then that sort of kills it for everybody else then, really. These fish, like the fish that we're fishing for nowadays, I mean, they're big, aren't they? There's so many big fish to go and fish for. I don't think they're bothered necessarily about eating maggots so much. I think after time they're after a bit of steak and chips, not so if they know they're going to feed, they may as well make it worth it and eat some proper grub.
Is it what do you think it is about the maggots and casters? Is it just the fact that they're natural foods, or just the fact that they don't see them all year, or that they're different, or what was it?
The amino acid level, the actual, if you break down like maggots, casters, and especially worms, like worms are used highly in like botanics, like because of the amino acids and all of that. They're actually really, really good for everything, worms. We've been using them for years. All like what you'd class as a natural bait, like maggots, casters, and worms. And also it's time of year as well. In the spring, you're fishing more off the bottom than you are on the bottom, like come sort of end of February, March into April. It's only when you sort of get that big weather change, when you get those first couple of weeks of decent weather, like low pressures, warm winds, then they'll have a go on anything. After they've been fished for a little bit throughout the summer, after spawning, that's when they want that replenishment, all those like sort of nutrients, the amino acids and that sort of thing. And because they've been fished for so much, also
there's a few anglers in the country, and it's literally a handful that I've noticed over the last few years that absolutely hammer lakes. Quite often the pressured commercial lakes as well, the likes of the Linears, Bluebells, places like that. And you and Kev are two of a very small number of people that seem to do this. Now, all these guys have one thing in common, and that's a great big bucket of spod mix that they're continually baiting, regular spobbing. Now, I've watched some of these guys. There's a chap who fishes Cromwell near us, and he hammers bluebell regularly, and he outfishes everybody else by such a ridiculous amount on what is a tricky lake that everybody, and he's quite secretive as well about it, about his spod mix. He won't let anybody look in his gear and or see his rigs. Now, I can't work out if there's something tricky in the spod mix or if it's just the physicality of spomming every 20 minutes, every half hour, day and night. Now, have you got any secrets in your spod mix, or do you think it's the regular baiting?
I just think it's just application. It's just fishing. You know, you've got to be in the right area. It doesn't matter. You could have, you know, there's no, I don't believe in sort of wonder baits. You know, we got the baits that we got. Our country and our, you know, we've never been as advanced as we are now, and we're absolutely spoiled for bait. So I don't think there's any bait that anybody could have that they, you know, you're just, the fish just start swimming from the other end of the lake down to wherever this bloke's fishing because he's got the best bait in the world. I just think that's nonsense. Carp are where they are in the lake because they want to be there.
Yeah.
Anybody that's got half a brain in fishing, you know, if they can climb a tree and see a load of carp in a corner, they fish from there, they're going to catch one there. If you know, and you've only got to look to like the likes of like Simon Crowe, Steve Briggs, Rob Hughes in that era, and that is why they're so consistent. You know, and like Simon won't mind me saying this, but like if you ever watch Simon fish, he's probably like one of the basic anglers that I've ever seen fish. And also like for big fish, I mean, like a great inspiration for my fishing, the big fish fishing, Mark Holmes, you know, he catches, and he's from, you know, I don't know, I'll put him in the same era as all of them. He's a little bit older, but you know, he catches a phenomenal amount of big fish. And you know, that's not because they got any wonder bait, because they haven't. It's just application, the way you put it. For spod mixes, I think you can just keep things ever so simple. And basically, all you've got to do, and the way that you applicate what you're doing and how you're fishing, is you need to sort of, one, go to the lake, look around the lake and think, where is my best chance of catching a carp out of this lake? And everybody's of a different ability as well. So, like, everybody will look at a lake to look at. You know, you'll never get two views the same because the ability is always a little bit different, their mindset as well. So you just got to go to the lake for how you fish. Like, someone's always better off doing something that they're confident in than trying to mimic someone else and doing it badly and just messing up. So if they fish, you know, because like, some people, you know, I could go to say B1, for instance, I'm thinking, right, I'm gonna fish out in the middle. I'm gonna spot on a sixpence at 130 yards, and I'm gonna catch him spotting over zigs. Now, the bloke next to me might think, "Well, I can't spot 130 yards, but there's a few fish crashing down there in the bay. I could sneak down there, chuck a couple of bags out, and probably nick a bite." So, and that's what you've got to do. You've just got to take your own fish in, and when you get to the lake, have a walk around the lake and think, right, you know, what's good for me here? How am I gonna get these fish the best way I can? And yeah, if it's in the middle of the pond, spotting it up in the middle and catching them off the bottom, then fine. If it's down in the corner of the bay, either floater fishing or catching on bags, just dropped it in the margins and walked back to the peg. Then, you know, if you've caught a carp, you've caught a carp. It doesn't matter how you catch it. No one's any worse or better for catching it. You've caught it, and that's what you're there to do. It doesn't matter how you fish for them. But that's what I'd say, because you wouldn't want to be. It's all right, say spotting. Like every 20 minutes, every half an hour in the right situation. And yeah, don't get me wrong, like me and Kev, like our deal in the British Championships, because everybody always questions me and Kev, they say, oh, how come Bart always plays the fishing? And the deal is, right, that Kev loves spotting, and right, he's probably the, you know, most accurate person I know. Like, we always make a joke, because you'll be looking at the tree on the far side, and we'll always be like, oh, that tree's taking a bit of a punishing, but just because it's down, you know, it's down that plug hole every time. So the deal is, he loves spotting, so he does the spotting, and yeah, like, you know, I don't go fishing as much as Kev. Our lives are a bit different, you know. I've got a lot on. I was only talking to you the other day about what I do for work and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, this conversation's taken a couple of days to get together because I've been so busy. And so the deal is that I play the fishing. Now, if we catch a carp, me and Kev have gone there and we've caught it. It doesn't matter what it is. And like at Raysbury, when we won the final this year, we've had a couple of big originals. Now, I played them in. Kev cast the rod out, he spotted up. I played them in and done all of that.
Yeah.
Who caught the fish? You know, yeah. We caught it together. Like, you know, is Kev going to chuck that rod 12 rod lengths any better than what I could?
Yeah.
You know, we're of a similar ability. We use exactly the same rigs everywhere we go. It's, you know, he's caught. We just sat there at that swim. He said, what are we going to do to get the best out of this peg? And it's like, well, we'll have a spot there. We caught that fish there. Now, I know that Kev has fished Raysbury. Like, to me, I haven't spent a bit of time on Raysbury. Kev has. So when we caught those fish, we had a couple of photos, and we said to people, like, look, you know, if any photos are to be used from this, it's of the two of us. And, like, you know, deep down, Kev caught them. In my eyes, Kev caught those fish. And he was going to put the fish back, to be fair. And I said, don't be so stupid. Pick that fish up and have some proper stills with it on your own. You fished here for 2 years with that fish.
Yeah.
For that fish. And he turned around and said, all right, well, as long as you don't mind. Like, you know, to me, yeah, it was a 40-pounder, and it is, you know, it's a really lovely carp to catch. But I've not gone there in the past and targeted that fish, whereas Kev has. So that fish actually means a great deal to him more than what it does to me. And that's, you know, that's all we do, is we go fishing to enjoy it. And that's the deal. Yeah, Kev does the spotting, I do the winding in. And as long as we know, yeah, we'll try and get a check for $20,000 at the end of it.
Well, I mean, the way you two fear, it's different if, you know, my mate, you know, I was up at the toilet or something and my mate reeled a fish in on my rods, because he hasn't caught that fish. He doesn't use my rigs. He doesn't fish the same way. You know, he wouldn't have found that spot. Whereas you two, you would, it didn't really matter which one. You'd have both been fishing exactly the same way on the same spot with the same rig, with the same bait application. And that is a true team effort, I think. You know, as opposed to someone just walking into my swim picking up one of my rods, you know.
Like we knew, right, when we drew the peg that we got this year in the final, we knew that the right hand side of the swim was going to be better than the left.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've walked into the peg, we're putting our gear down, and I thought, I'll wake Kev up here, because I know how much he loves to batter it. Kev loves it. He just like there's no one more up for fishing than what he is. And I've put my rod bag down in the right hand side of the swim. I'll be like, oh, I'll just go in the right then, Kev, if you know, you're right at the left, aren't you? And I've seen his head drop because I knew that he wanted to go on the right. And I said, yeah, I'll just bivvy up in here, mate. You're right on the left, aren't you? Because, you know, just, and you know, you went all a bit quiet. I was like, don't be so stupid, get in there. You know, don't bother me. I spent half the match looking at an island. I had my buzz bars and never even had a rod on it. But the year before, I fished my couple of rods and pretty much won the final just on my little spot. So it's, yeah, we just sit there, you look at the peg, and it's no different, like, however much bait you feel like you should put in or put in wherever. But you just got to go to your lake, find the swim that you think is best for you to catch carp from, the way you fish, and apply your bait and your bait application for that. Now, that being said, but you saying, you know, spotting every half hour, every 3 hours or whatever, yeah, that's how we like to fish. So what we do is, if you look at the venues that we actually fish and the pegs that we actually fish, you know, out of the size of the lake, there's probably only two or three deep, like, pegs that we would fish on each lake, because that's the way we like to fish. You know, I wouldn't, and I've always got, I got a joke with Rob Hughes, because you know, like a lot of the lads in England team, they do like to fish far out, because it's just, I don't know, it's just something about when you're crunching a rod and, you know, twatting a spot as far as you can, it's just something good about it. I suppose it's a bit like when you're younger and you're kicking a football from one end of the football pitch to the other, sort of, you get a bit of satisfaction thinking, yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
So we cherry pick how we want to fish. Now, that's just that. So, yeah, it's just the way it is.
So you're saying you want to fish a certain style. You would pick a swim where you can put kind of all your rods on one spot and then just keep hammering that one spot. You think it's accuracy and application? Are you looking for places you can fish in that style?
Yeah, 100%. You know, you can, pick these venues, and it does literally boil down to what weather you've got coming in, sort of all the factors building up to it. The actual fishing is quite, because well, we do fish quite basically, you know, what we'll do is we'll put our bait in one spot and we'll put all our hooks over the top of it.
Yeah.
We don't believe in, like, there are certain situations and certain types of lakes that, you know, and we wouldn't sort of cut our nose off to spite our face, so to speak, because if we felt like we had to have, if we had a swim where you needed like two zigs over there, one rod up against the island there and one down the margin, then we would do that. We wouldn't just drop and spot it up in the middle just for the sake of it. You know, we just generally, like, we'll fish a peg where, and because we like to, we're greedy, you know, we do want to catch a lot of carp. To get those big hits, fishing in open water where, you know, where the carp are shoaled up, and up for a bit of a feed, you know, that's where you're going to get the big hits. So, you know, I don't know many places where you can always tick over getting a few bites, but I don't know many places where you just, you know, you haul, like, fishing up to, like, isolated features or at short range, you know, that sort of thing. So for our pleasure fishing, we just cherry pick where we want to go and apply that to our matches. You know, like this year in the British Championships, because we won it the year before, we were lucky to qualify straight through to B1. Mm. Now, B1 is a fantastic lake for, like, learning how to fish for pressure fish. You know, it opened in 2007, and it's had fish down there every weekend, rain or shine, you know, since then. And those fish, they're cute. And it's a great place to actually learn how to fish. But not only that, if you get it right, you know, you can have such fantastic weekends fishing. I mean, you could literally catch sort of 20 or 30 20s in a weekend, and a few 30s to boot as well. And, you know, it doesn't matter what lake you go to, if you're catching 20 or 30 20s and 30s in a weekend, having a barbecue in the sunshine, just chilling out, then, you know, if that ain't fishing, I don't know what is.
Yeah. So you mentioned the natural food in there. Obviously, at places like Linear and stuff, you can't use the maggots, the worms and stuff anymore. Are you replacing that amino in your spod mix? You're putting anything to kind of counteract the fact that you've got less aminos in there? Any juices or anything that, or are they all top secret?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've been looking to try and, you know, there are various amino acids that you can get and flavorings. I don't think the amino acids are so important at the start of the year. I think, you know, you're more sort of liquids are a massive thing in my fishing. Absolutely love them. And you know, especially like sort of quite heavy liquids that when you put them in, they'll stain the bottom.
Yeah.
And you know, that can keep fish in your peg, and all you're doing is when you catch one, I think you're just sort of, if it's in your peg feeding and it's kicking all the, you know, all the debris up off the bottom and all those liquids, you're just lining up your next bite. And yeah, so like early on in the year, sort of either like a tiger nut food liquid, something that's quite sort of sweet and caramelly. You know, even with corn, you could put a bit of betel in with it, you know, just a tiny bit, just to sweeten it up a little bit. Anything like that. And then just when you go, you know, when they're having it, you can use sort of fish oils and like fish sort of hydroslates, like liver liquids. And then back end of the year, that's when I think you need to be looking for those tiny little edges. I'm actually using one at the moment from Dynamite called Fish Guts. It's like a little feeding trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be quite good as well.
What's a typical spod mix look like then? You know, like what's your key things that are in every time? And then when you say you're putting liquid in, like how much liquid are you putting in?
So, like spod mix-wise, for sort of, I'd say 80% of the waters that I go to, it'd be something like 10 mil tiger nut boilies, hemp and corn. The corn would probably make up like 60% of the mix. and then I'd have like 20% Tenma boilies and hemp.
Yeah.
And then all I do is, like, I don't think you can hold, like, liquids. I wouldn't say that, you know, they're not cheap, unless you use like stuff like molasses, or, you know, like that type of liquid, like bulk animal feed liquids, but angling liquids, like, you know, that are within the trade. I mean, you wouldn't want to fill a 17 litre bucket up.
No.
So yeah, so you just got to, like, you know, I'd probably use a litre bottle, sort of per 24 hours, I'd say.
Yeah.
I have actually started using a bit of ground bait again. I went to Bluebell a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to get those, that amino acid that I got to the bottom.
Yeah.
So once I'd got my spod mix, I'd actually just mixed it with some dark ground bait, and in there over the year, there's like a fine layer of black scum on the bottom.
Yeah.
From where the algae's died and just sunk and rotted on the bottom. Because it did have a big algae bloom on. And so what I wanted to do was just make that bottom where I was fishing smell as pleasant as possible.
Right.
Once I got, like, my loose feed, like my hemp and my corn and my little 10mm boilies I wanted to put in, I just mixed that with some black swim stim ground bait just to make it, like, clumpy so I could squeeze it in a soft ball in one hand as I was loading it into the spod. Just yeah. So, and it was quite windy as well, so I wanted the bait to get right down. It was like 12 foot deep, so I wanted it to get right down on the spot without drifting everywhere. So you just form this little ball, it go down, and, you know, when the fish come in the peg, and they start nudging, you know, nudging it around and puffing those balls up, all it's doing is just sort of sending out more food signals, and all you're going to end up doing is catching more fish, I think.
Have you had a look at that, like the hydro wheat liquids, DNA and stuff, the really heavy stuff that seems to, like, sink to the bottom like a brick and then it just spreads out in an area? Have you used those sort of liquids? I don't know, yeah, like, Holmesy goes, like, on about them all the time, doesn't he?
Yeah, Mark's a big fan of liquids, so I mean, those liquids, they are heavy and they're you know, they're perfect for that sort of thing. And I just think with the liquids, like a liver liquid, it's a bit thinner. You know, like that sort of thing. To get it to the bottom, the only way you can actually get it to the bottom is if you put it in something. So, like, a hard ball ground bait is the way to get to the bottom. But, like you say, those thicker liquids, they're fine just to have loose. What I would do, though, is I'd put some in the spod mix and mix it around. But yeah. What you find is, because of the natural juices of the hemp and the corn, it dilutes it and it goes just as watery as the other liquid in the bucket. Now, right. what I would do is load the spod and then with those thicker liquids, tip it in the spod, in the center of the, like, so half fill your spod, pour a load of liquid in the center of the spod, then put the rest of your spod mix on, close your spod, and then they're sort of almost trapped in the middle. Mm-hmm. And then what you'll find is that it will go down in a bit of a clump before it breaks up. It won't sort of dilute itself through the water column. It'll actually get right to the bottom and disperse and break down on the bottom, especially like in the colder months, where it doesn't, you know, doesn't disperse so quickly. And to be fair, when you want to put less food in, those sort of liquids are better now, like this time going into now, just because you can have a massive, you know, you could crumb up a load of boilie and put it in with that liquid, and all it's going to do is just ooze attraction, and you don't have to necessarily have a great food content there, but you've got the same amount of attraction, and all you need then is three rigs over the top, and you're fishing really, really effectively for them for this time of year.
I've seen fish react to liquids. There was one story I've told a few times on the Carpcast about pouring some sort of melted ice cream into in Blackpool. You've got the Pleasure Beach, and there used to be a ride that had water underneath it and loads of carp that had been in there like 20, 30 years. There was some quite big ones in there, a load of 30s, and it never been fished for. But there was you could buy pellets from a machine for like 50p and throw them in, and they were so tame, these fish. Anyway, we used to go down there, and there was like a famous ice cream shop. If you ever come to Blackpool, and Notriani's, it's been there about 120 years, this shop. It's like a Italian recipe, and everyone goes there when it's hot. But so we've gone down to Notriani's, and it's right by this sort of area where you could feed the fish from. And the ice cream is melting in this tub. I could see these carp that are about 30 yards away, all in a group, and I poured this ice cream in, this melted ice cream, and it just, as you know, with sort of milky carnation-y type stuff we used to put in spod mixes years ago, it just made a massive cloud of attraction in the water. It just spread out as soon as it hit the water, and these fish, I don't know if it was the sound of the ice cream being poured in, but they did hear it or smelt it or whichever combination of the two. They came over in a group, and there was no food content in there. It was just a cloudy, liquidy area, and these fish went crazy in there, like trying to eat it. I've never seen a reaction like it in my whole life. And because there was no food particle for them to eat, it was like, I don't know, it just made them really excited. They were swimming about like through this cloud and just, you know, going back and forwards through it. And they all came over, and I don't know, it just made me, I've still not used liquids excessively. I always pour some in a spod mix, but I don't think I go to the detail that you're doing, but I should be seeing that reaction. It was, you know, it was a combination of a number of things, I think, and obviously a sweet, cloudy taste, you know, a sweet cloud. But the fact that there was nothing for him to eat made him want to eat more almost. It sort of excited him because they knew it was food triggers, but no food.
they feed really hard on liquids. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure like most carp anglers have had a tank, you know, like a fish tank with a few baby carp in them, and you know, they can't help themselves but crumb a boilie up or tip a bit of liquid or a bit of flavouring in just to see the reaction. And they do, they go wild. They, you know, they start ripping the bottom up, and that's what you want. If you can create that competition, especially if you can, like, cause I always think it's easier when you're fishing for a few more fish, it's easier to get that bite than it is fishing just for one fish, just because it's so on edge all the time. Whereas when you've got, you know, when you've got sort of other animals that are coming in, that is sort of,
it's just the competition, creating a feeding situation. And I don't use liquids enough. But so are you putting anything, you know, you hear about people putting tuna and sort of fishy type things in a mix. Are you doing any of that?
No, I don't. I've never used a lot of tuna, to be fair. I mean, I use a fair bit of like krill meal, maggot, you know, like shrimp meal, that sort of thing. You know, especially like when we were doing a lot of maggot fishing, I think you sort of had to make the maggots stand out a little bit, and what we used to do is clean the maggots off, we would flavor them with a few little bits and bobs, and then have them with like either krill or shrimp meal as well, just to sort of, you know, just to sort of make our maggots stand out a little bit. And it's
you make it sound very simple, but it sounds to me like you're actually doing quite a lot of little tweaks and edges, and you're thinking about it constantly to be slightly different to everybody else.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, yeah, maybe it's just because I've done it for so many years. But yeah, literally just go just sort of think about what you're doing, how you're fishing, who else. Because the lakes are busy nowadays, and like people say to us, like, oh, don't you get fed up of fishing those day ticket waters, you know, with everybody else? And like, yeah, they are busy, but they are, you know, that's what makes the fish hard to catch is all the other anglers.
Yeah.
So it's still quite rewarding going fishing and, you know, fishing not only against the fish, but fishing sort of with everybody else. And, you know, it just keeps you hungry to trying to catch the bites, because otherwise it would be like, oh, rock up down the syndicate, get the rods out, jump in the sleeping bag sort of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if you're there to do a job, like, you know, do a job effectively, and no one wants to blank. I know everyone will blank, and that is part of it. You can't have it great all the time. But it does keep you thinking about it all the time as well. It's like, oh, everyone's using that up there. How can I make it a bit better? What can I do to just stand out a little bit? Or, It sounds, you know, just fish a bit more effectively.
It sounds like you're very competitive, and you're kind of competing every time you go when you're fishing the busy waters, because you're competing with the people around you, really, aren't you? Because you are, you know, the other anglers are as important a factor as the fish, I guess, on busy lakes. So I wonder if it's just your competitive streak that keeps you going on them waters.
Yeah, maybe. And I think also it does, you know, when you've got a big lake as well, I think it makes them easier to fish, because everybody's there fishing. So all the fish, they're not tucked up on the end of the wind pushing into the, you know, a certain bank or in the bay, because you've got people fishing in the bay with lines and sort of, you know, their presence is known to the fish, and as well with everything else. So it does make it easier to catch them, because I think you know where you stand with the fish, because they know they're being fished for, so they sit out in the middle being a bit grumpy. But it's just sort of working it out, and once you've worked it out, sort of applying it nice and neat, and sort of that, yeah, that spot in every half an hour. Like if you were just to keep draining that spot in over the top of them, or payloading massive loads of bait, the fish aren't, they're not going to tolerate it. All they'll do is they'll just back off you or move to the side of you. And, you know, and with lakes nowadays, you don't have that luxury just to move up the lake a bit more or like go around to the other side. You know, you've got to be very careful in how you fish. So, that application and stuff is when you knit it all together. Like I took an old boy fishing, Terry used to be the bailiff for my lake, and he always used to say to me, so it's all about percentages with you. And I said, oh, what do you mean? He goes, oh, well, if you take like 5% here and 10% here and sort of 60% actually going out the door and actually going fishing, once you knit it all together, you get like, you know, you get that 100, 110%. So the bite isn't ever too far away then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, Terry Hearn said something very similar. I always remember when I was a lot younger, he called it the 1%. And you can do what everybody else does, but if your hook is slightly sharper than the next guy's, that's 1%. If you've paid a bit more attention to your application, that's another 1%. And all of a sudden, all these little things, it all seems slightly insignificant, but you're fishing 10% better than everybody else. And that's why you get the exceptional results. It's you know, the 1%. So, how much is zig fishing a part of your day to day fishing and match fishing?
Oh, massive! Really. Yeah, it does play a huge part. Especially, I've lost count of the amount of times that I've actually qualified for things like the British Championships, where the venues are, you know, the weather hasn't suited the venue, or it's a bit, little bit too cold. But the amount of times that I've qualified just by rocking up and chucking four zigs out and not actually putting any bait out is it's just brilliant. I mean, we used to fish on St. John's back before they sort of put a lot more fish in there than they've got now. And, you know, the fishing was just awesome on zig fishing. Lynch Hill, when... when that used to allow zigs, we used to fish, and some of the bites that you get are crazy. I mean, we've caught sort of 60 and 70 pound catfish 8 inches under the surface at the middle of the night, hooked plumb in the bottom lip, just on a tiny, tiny piece of back foam, along with a carp as well. It'd be blowing an absolute hoolie. You'd be fishing 12 inches under the surface in 14 foot of water, and in the middle of the night, it just goes. And then there's no, you know, I do it because it works, and like you'll always do it, and I understand that it works. And there's two very different ways to fish it. Now, you can either fish them static, so like the best thing you're going to do is if you're going to go and you want to fish that way, I'd say fish that way when it's either cold, or like I say, look at the lake and what everyone else is catching and do something different. If you've got 50 blokes out in the lake and nothing's being caught on the bottom, then I wouldn't even put any bait out. I'd like maybe put some bait out, but I certainly wouldn't put a rod on it. I'd be looking at fishing off the bottom from the start. But if you're going to try it, you've got to go, you've got to put three rods on it, and just be confident. Just sort of take it, be confident, but be relaxed with it at the same time, and say, right, I'm going to go and try it, I'm going to do it. If I don't catch, I don't catch. You know, if I do catch, then it's bonus. And you've literally got to leave your bait at home, so to speak, and go and try it for the first time. When you understand it, it's great, because you know when to put them out and all of that.
That's the next question is, when you arrive at a lake, if you know, you're going to St John's for the weekend or whatever, it's quite busy. I mean, do you ever wander around, ask everybody if they're catching off the bottom, or would you automatically put zigs out right at the start, or like, yeah, tell us when you would put a zig out. Is it your first choice, or?
Yeah, not always. Depends on the time of year. Like, up until sort of like now, like, you know, September, October, early part of November, I would choose not to use zigs, no matter what lake I was fishing on, because I don't think that you necessarily catch those, you know, those A-team fish.
Yeah.
You know, like the really big ones. I think when they feed, they're feeding on the bottom. They're not swimming around, you know, they're big old girls. They're not swimming around the lake up sort of right under the surface. Don't get me wrong. They'll go cruising now and again, if it's nice and sunny in the winter and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like if you're not worried about numbers and you just want to catch an 18, then I'd say stay fishing on the bottom, because I don't think that you're going to necessarily catch those real big ones on the zigs. If I was looking to zig fish, I would just, same as normal, just turn up. Oh, what's being caught? Well, there's 20 blokes here. They fished it for 48 hours. There's been three fish out. There's 1,800 fish in the lake. Well, yeah. Like, you've got your answer there staring you in the face.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be, I would either find the most amount of water that I could find, as in, like, sort of where they'd be sat at in the middle of the pond away from everybody else, or the deepest water, and that's where I'd be aiming, to fish off the bottom. You know, if you went to St. John's and you went up in you could only get a swim up in the back bay, or the fish were showing up in the back bay, you wouldn't be going up there chucking out zigs, because it's only sort of 4 to 6 foot deep. And you know that it's not going to take much for the carp to drop down onto the bottom. So, you know, that's there. I mean, the luxury that we have got is that everybody knows now, especially like with Facebook or stuff like that. It doesn't take much to know, oh, so-and-so's been fishing that lake. He's been doing really well. I might drop him a message just to see if he knows where the fish are.
Yeah.
You know, because every little helps. It always does. So you've got that added advantage. If you go to like somewhere like Linya, you've got the bailiffs that are walking around sort of two times a day, so they know who's caught what, and they're a great help, especially because Linya is almost like a communal venue that everybody goes to, but no one really knows each other. Do you know what I mean? Because you've got so many different groups of anglers fishing there.
Yeah.
So the bailiffs are a massive help with where the fish are. Whereas if you were to fish somewhere like a different water that was either one side of the country or the other, or a syndicate, then or a venue that you don't fish regularly, then you may have to just message someone that, you know, a mate of a mate, just to say, all right, mate, you know, don't suppose you've got any pointers on going down there, if you know.
So you turn up at one of these lakes, there's been three fish out all weekend, you're looking for the deepest area with a load of open water, you put three rods on zigs. What depths are you starting off at? It's 12 foot deep. What do you put out first?
It's probably 7 to 11 foot. I'd always start in the top third. Like three quarter, like two thirds of, yeah, the top sort of third of the water column.
Yeah.
And then only I mean, like, me and Tom had it off a few winters ago on Oxley's. I think we had 105 bites in, I can't remember, it was like 48 hours, I think it was.
Wow.
Now, we only found those fish because we chucked the marker rod out, and as we're feeling it down, because that was like 14 foot deep, and as we were chucking it out, you could literally feel it banging off the backs of the carp.
Right.
And I used to do that in my match fishing, like, years ago, when I used to fish up at Larford Lakes, and that's 14 foot deep, and it's quite a big lake. And what I used to do is, when I used to plumb up at the start of the match, because, you know, I'd still plumb up for feeder fishing.
Yeah.
But what I'd do is chuck like a little half ounce bomb, and I would keep casting out until I felt the fish on the way down with like a really light quiver tip rod with braid.
Yeah.
And where I felt it going over the backs of the fish, that's where I'd start fishing on the method feeder.
Yeah.
Because that's the range where the carp are.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always done really well. And all I'd do is I'd dip my method feeder in a big pot of liquid, roll it around in a load of dry ground bait. So when the feeder went out, it would sort of like almost leave like a trace column going down through the water column of this dry sort of ground bait and smell.
Yeah.
And you know what they're like in a fish tank when you pour liquid in, they yeah. smell it and they literally, it's like someone's got a rope and just pulled them down and you get a bite straight away. And you'd have a bite in say like 5 minutes after casting out.
Yeah.
And then you just chuck it somewhere else then and try and find something else. And it's, yeah, with the zigs, they like same thing. They sit up off the bottom. But that particular year on Oxley, sorry, we felt them a lot lower down.
Yeah.
And you could physically feel the lead. You'd go right down and then just sort of when it was probably about 6 foot off the bottom, it would go bang, 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 and then hit the bottom. And so straight away we chucked a shorter zig out and we were catching those on 3 to 4 foot little yellow zigs. And that goes hand in hand with like the higher in the water column I would fish like a darker hook bait. So like normally it's always like black or black and yellow up high, red or yellow down lower.
That's interesting. Now I've seen a lot of you match guys using the red foam, and I thought it was just an alternative, but you're using the red foam when you're fishing in sort of the lower half of the lake, would you say?
Yeah, 100%. It just seems to, I don't know, it just works. And I mean, we have messed about with other colours, but I think, to be honest, I don't think the colours play that big a difference. I think the lower down, the lower the light levels, you just want sort of a slightly, you know, like even an orange. Orange does quite well on those dark, gloomy days.
Yeah.
It does depend on sort of what the water's like where you're fishing, because the beauty you've got up at places like Linear, Bluebell, even Drayton, they are, you know, they're fairly clear waters.
Yeah.
So the hook bait choice doesn't matter too much. Whereas if you were to fish, say, somewhere like Top of Manor, My Lake, that sort of place, you need a bright hook bait for sure.
Very interesting. Are you flavouring the foam or anything, or is it just straight up foam?
We have flavoured them over the years, but I don't think. Because sometimes, like, if you're fishing for a lot of fishing, like, say, when we go to Drayton, you catch 50 fish in a day, then possibly you could get some quicker bites flavour in it. When we were fishing in Christchurch and St. John's, those zigs could be out there for, like, even if you said, oh, you had a great session and you caught 20 fish in a weekend, you know, over 3 rods, the actual rod hours, that's not a lot of bites on each rod, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So no matter what, there's not a flavour that you could put on anything that would last that long in the water to make such an impact that you want it to. So I don't think it matters too much. I think they're just, it's either sight, you know, sight, all zig stuff is pretty much sight, or they're sort of like their natural receptors that are indicating that there's something there that they can possibly eat.
Yeah. I asked Carl when we interviewed him about the tackle for the distance fishing. Are you guys all using the same, the Technium line with a braided leader if you can, or you got any chucking tips?
No, that's with chucking tips, yeah. I mean, like there's a lot of great, you know, great rods that you can use nowadays that are that will cast a long, long way. There's also, I believe in that it's just technique. You wouldn't be able to cast as far with, you know, it's like a car. You weren't going to buy a top performance car for the same money as what you just buy a car that is just about on the road.
Mm.
you know, and ask it to do 140 mile an hour. Yeah. So yeah, you do literally pay for what you get. But there's still some very, you know, there's still some great gear that is relatively cheap to fish a long, long way. What I would say is anyone that wants to fish a long way is either get yourself booked up with someone like Terry Edmonds, get out for a day with him. He'll put sort of 40 or 50 yards on pretty much everybody, other than sort of like a 10% bracket of carp anglers that sort of know what, you know, that distance.
Yeah.
And have done professional like casting or whatever. But he will pretty much put 40 or 50 yards on everybody. And when I say that, I mean, like, even like you see it at the shows, even guys that think that they're not going to be able to improve, and someone like Terry could actually still improve them. For rods and fishing a long way in situations, you can only, you know, you've still got to be fair to the fish and fish safely. So if the fish are well out of your range and, you know, you're going to start, like, cracking off or losing rigs and snags with fish on them and stuff, then obviously it's a no-no. But if it's, if the conditions allow it for you to fish a long, long way with light line, because you're not going to fish a massive range without using light line. I mean, for sort of 90% of my fishing, certainly in this country, I'll always use a braided leader if I can. If the lake rules allow it, it's just something that I've always done. I know that Kev is exactly the same. And it's something that, I don't know why, you've just got so much more control when you're casting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just brilliant. But you can still use that with, just because you've got a braided leader on, doesn't mean that you can't use a decent mainline. Like, I'll still use a braided leader with, say, like an 18-pound line.
Right.
Just because of that control. Now, obviously, if an 18-pound line will go a certain distance, and then obviously if you want to go beyond that, then you need to be looking at, obviously, downsizing the diameter of your mainline to go further and further. But, I mean, for run-of-the-mill, like, just for a safe long-distance setup, I would say 13-pound Exocet with, like, a 30-pound Armadillo leader. Now, that is just a great setup for fishing a really good distance, because we don't have the lakes where we can go and fish. Like, I can cast a long way, but it's every now and again. Like, yeah, you pick a rod up and go and fish at 150 plus yards, whereas 99% of your fishing is done, I'd say, anywhere from 40 to 125, 130 yards maximum, yeah, just because of the lakes that we've got. There's nowhere that you can go, and the types of waters that we fish. Like, maybe if you had a syndicate, say, like Rockford, Dinton, I know, like, those, yeah, sort of waters, then, yeah, fair enough, you could do it week in, week out. Like, I know Carl goes to Grenville,
yes,
and he does it there, and yeah, that's fine. But I think on 95% of day ticket waters, you're not going to be fishing past a distance where you wouldn't, you need anything less than a sort of 16 or a 13-pound line.
Fantastic. Tell us about your lake. You've mentioned your lake a couple of times. How long have you had it? What have you done with it? What type of place? How much have you learned from having your own lake and observing the fish?
I went to, when I left school, I went to Sparshall College with Lee Mozza Morris. Me and him, that's how we know each other so well.
Okay.
I lived at his mum's house for a couple of years. Then I went to Sparshall. Simon Scott was our lecturer there. Got on really well. And then finished my course, come back, said to my dad, let's buy a field, dug a lake. That was in the winter of 2000. It's called Acorn Carp Fishery. It's just sort of just south side of Bristol, near Weston-super-Mare.
Yeah.
It's 3¾ acres, the main lake. There's probably around 300 fish in there at the moment. 100 odd 20s, and I'd say anywhere from 4 to 6 30s at the moment.
Mm.
It's really good. Got a nice little family run business there. I run all my other business from there as well. Couple of match lakes, and yeah, it's just a really, really nice setup. We just built a house for my mum and dad there, and so they're moving into that in the spring.
Is your house there? Did you build yourself a house on it as well?
No, it's like my mum and dad are living there, because it's a bit iffy with the planners all around there. So we got to be a bit tactical now with how we get another one on there.
That's the dream, isn't it? Build a lake, dig a house, build a house. Fantastic view every morning, carp swimming about. It's every carp angler's dream, I guess. That is, and you seem to have done it.
It's been a lot of hard work. It's paying off now. I mean, our family, we were a bit, when we started it all, we sort of didn't have a pot to pee in, so to speak. But now it's been a tough slog, but we're there now. We all see the light at the end of the tunnel. And yeah, it's great. It's nice just to sort of be talking about fishing every day, seeing it, I've watched some sort of good anglers from my area sort of start from nothing and progress. and watch them sort of get better and better in their own fishing. And yeah, they do stop fishing my place because it is only a small little water and that. And I see them like go off to the likes of Horseshoe and up in your own places and going like further afield. Mm. But it's nice just to watch, you know, just to watch it progressing over the years.
Has it taught you a lot as well, like the habits of the fish, just having that, if you work in there or your base is there, you're observing those fish daily, I guess?
Yeah and no. Like I mean, you know, I'm mega busy. So, I mean, this year I think I've done one night on my place.
Right.
So to put it into that perspective, and it is frustrating at times because... I've got mates of mine, they'll be like, oh, can I come fishing another night? And then every 10 minutes you're getting a message, or every hour, oh, I've just done another 20, and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, bloody hell, I've got to go out on site, or I've got to go, and those trees aren't going to get sorted out, or I've got to go put that fence up, or go and sort stock pond out. And yeah, so it's a double edged sword, you know what I mean? But I wouldn't have it any other way. We've got, for where I live in this part of the country, is a really, really good lifestyle, to be fair. I'm never going to have a pot of gold that's a mile high, but yeah. It's, you know, such a lovely way of life. And it's great that my kids now, I mean, they're only young, but I've just had my second, which is a boy. So hopefully, yes, good training ground now, so I can get him on it.
Yeah.
And train him up to be...
future match world champion maybe.
that'd be nice.
Do you ever walk past the lake? Maybe you've got a match coming up the following weekend and maybe it's slow or it's in the winter or whatever. Do you ever like look at your lake and go, blimey, the fish seem to be in a certain depth, or and they're on the back of the wind this week, that's the first place I'm going to look when I go fishing to Lanier at the weekend or wherever you're going? Does it ever like just give you a leg up, as it were?
Yeah, I think it does play a part. And I think you just get an understanding for sort of how they're behaving. It's a bit like, you know, when you look in your garden pond and you see all the fish like all huddled up off the bottom, all the goldfish just sat there almost leant over a little bit sideways, just not really feeling the love. It gets you in that mindset, whether you can be sort of aggressive or whether you just got to feel your way into your session.
Yeah.
Because at times, like, you know that if it's like May and you've got a low pressure and a nice southwesterly coming in, it's going to be sort of a little bit drizzly, but still going to be like 21 degrees. You know that you can tank a couple of buckets of bait in and it's not really going to make much of a difference. Yeah. Whereas if it was on the other hand, if it was sky high pressure and like, I don't know, like an easterly wind and it just felt a bit horrible and a bit naff, then sort of you might just think, well, I'll just put 15 spots out to start with and maybe put like one on the bottom and two on zigs.
Yeah.
Like that sort of, yeah. So it does play, yeah. And like with my match fishing, it also plays because I've got a couple of match lakes as well. So I can have a go, like just sort of, you know, just setting a few rigs up or making sure my elastic's right in the pole or whatever. And you can just get a feel for sort of when you're fishing for mixed species, what fish are actually going to feed.
So it's great.
It's, you know, it is great to just have that accessibility to be able to just keep on top of your watercraft and just sort of, yeah, just know where you stand with the fish and just be in tune with what mood the fish are actually in.
Fantastic. Well, we've been over an hour now, so I know you're a very busy man. We can let you get back to what you do, but I'd like to say thank you for coming on talking to us on the Carpcast, and best of luck with everything that you do going forward.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under The Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course.
So a big thank you to Mark Bartlett. I really enjoyed conversation chatting with him. You can see why he's a top angler. And then, yeah, the match fishing techniques are the way. Moving on, the Carpcast Social, probably going to be, unless you come out and see me in Croatia or Slovenia next year, then it's probably going to be the only one, unless we get a winter one going back end of next year when I'm home in November or December. Maybe we cut up Clearwater or something. But the Carpcast Social in April is on Rob Hale's The Sitch, which is a fantastic, I think it's about 26 acre, it's like a sand pit, gravel, well, it's sort of sand and silt in a stunning forest in the Midlands. It's like on the sort of Shropshire West Midlands border, very easy to access from everywhere. The lake is stunning, lake records mid 40, they're growing like wildfire in there. Lots and lots of 30s, and it's one of those, it's well stocked, it's one of them. I think it's about 800 carp in there or something. If you listen back to the first Rob Hales interview, he actually went into detail on the stocks of all the lakes. But on most of the, it's a syndicate lake, you can't get a chance to fish it in the spring usually, but he does what's called open access, and we've booked a week. Mark's going to be there. You're doing the week, aren't you, Mark?
More than likely.
Yeah, depends if your missus is listening to this again, I guess.
If she's listening, I'll be punished and not allowed to go fishing again, but no. I do intend to be there for the full week.
Yes, there. I think we've got 5 or 6 people that are now on for the full week, so that there are no more full week spaces. There's a couple of spaces left for the... We're doing... it's Saturday to Saturday, and we're doing a trip on the Saturday to Tuesday with a barbecue on the Sunday night, done by firedupbarbecues.co.uk. Rich and Matt are coming down for the week. A couple of regulars on the Carpcast Socials as well. I've been to France with them guys as well. Great company. They're going to do a social and a bit of a piss up on the Sunday night. So there's a trip on the Saturday to the Tuesday, 3 nights. And then there's a changeover day on the Tuesday and the 4-night trip Tuesday till Saturday, where there will be a social probably on the Thursday night, so that we're not all hungover driving home Saturday. We'll probably do so. If you're doing the full week, you'll get 2 socials, and if you're doing either the 3-day or the 4-day trip, you'll still get one of the excellent barbecues and a few beers with Mark and myself. As I said, by the next Carpcast, it's probably going to be sold out. There's quite a few inquiries at the minute, and there's probably only 2 or 3 spaces left on either the 3-day or the 4-day trip. So I wouldn't hang about if you are up for that. And you can message myself or the Carpcast page or whatever if you want details on that. I mentioned Croatia a couple of times. I'm out there from April. The weeks are starting to fill up very nicely now. It's perfect if you want to go over there with your missus, you know, have a bit of a holiday around Lake Bled, do some fishing while you're there. We can accommodate any length of holiday. You can go exploring with your missus for a few days and come fishing for a few days. We've got traditional sort of fishing trips. Fly and survive. You fly over, we'll pick you up from the airport, take you to the respective lakes. And guarantee that you catch a load of fish. You would definitely catch a lot of fish, and there's a good chance of catching 40 pluses, up to 70 odd pound in all the lakes. It's absolutely stunning over there, and the fishing is amazing. Have a look at vipcarpholidays.com for more information and booking on there. On vipcarpholidays.com, the fantastic St. Amand. If you're looking for a family holiday, then we have St. Amand, which is a private 4.5 acre lake, a farmhouse that sleeps up to 10 people, games room, table tennis, all the facilities, everything you need over there. It's absolutely fantastic. You can even get 2 families on that particular holiday, and there's stuffed full of carp. You know, you'll be catching 5-10 carp a day, or up to 50 pound. It's an amazing holiday, and a different holiday on the River Lot. Our friend Jim Lightfoot has a villa, which again sleeps up to 8 people. You get 2 families in there, your own private fishing space, and bookings are just open for 2019 now. It sells out very quickly, that one. There's a swimming pool in the grounds of the villa. You can literally be swimming in the pool with the kids while the rods are out like a few meters behind you, and catching big fish of all species. There's huge catfish in there, there's huge sander, pike and big carp to 50 odd pound. Again, perfect holiday for the family. VIPcarpholders.com. And as I said, Jim's just opened bookings for 2019. There's nothing left for 2018 in sort of school holiday periods. There are odd weeks sort of early and late in the year available for next year, and the rest of it is 2019. Now, as you will find that lots of these sort of family holidays type places, they book up very early. So yeah, have a look at the VIPcarpholidays.com for that. And St. Amand, there is spaces next year all the way through. And St. Amand is a fantastic, like, one of the Carpcast listeners, in fact a lot of Carpcast listeners have been, every one of them's had an amazing time. And Ben Smethurst actually did a little blog on there for us, didn't he loved it, and booked again straight away when he got back. So VIPcarpholidays.com. Have you got anything else to say, Mark?
You know what, I don't think I have, to be honest. I've not actually been out fishing. There's nothing to report. So how about you? Have you ventured out?
I haven't this last week. Roger went to church late with one of his pals. They had a pretty good session, actually. Roger had two more of the A-team from church. He had the penny scale at 46 something. He had another 40 as well. And Paul Bowers, shout out to Paul, he had a PB as well, a 40 pounder. So yeah, considering the weather went cold, it fished pretty well last week. They had a good few bites between them. Not sure if I'll get back to church this year. I hope so. Let's go down and see Kevin. I'm definitely going to get a session on Clearwater. Obviously Clearwater, main sponsor of the Carpcast. I've seen all the fish go in there recently. Oh, Clearwater, actually, that's a little bit of news. Clearwater did what is probably the Lancashire record. It's big fish in there called Moonscale, came out at 46.6, which is huge for a lake that's practically in Scotland. No, it's not, it's in Carnforth, which is right on the Lancashire Lake District border. Alex has done some great work down there. We've told you all a lot about what he's doing. It's going to be one of the lakes in the country, let alone the north, within 2 or 3 years. I went down there the other week to have a look at a lot of the fish that he'd had stocked. He's doing the work on there this year, knocking the lake through, making the island and stuff. And just the thought that's gone into that lake, the fishery management, is amazing. And the fact that it's now got 340s in it. I think it had 630s with one scraper 40 when he took it over like 18 months ago, and there's 340 pluses, two of them common now, and the biggest has gone 46 and a half almost. So it's a testament to what good fishery management can do, because them fish had pretty much ploughed out before Alex took over, and obviously he's got a lot more plans. Told me about the fish he's got ordered for next year. He's not stopping. I think he spent 150, 180 grand on fish, something like that. Plus, obviously, he's inherited a reasonable stock anyway. He's got day ticket lakes on there, and all sorts. Clearwaterfisheries.co.uk. So yeah, I reckon I'll get a session down there. And as we discussed with Paul Harris, we're going to do a session on B1 or something, Mark.
Yeah, just to get out for the winter. I think I'm definitely going to get out for a long session this year on my birthday, which doesn't usually happen because it's in December, but I think I'm finally going to do it. Don't know where yet, but...
Yeah, that'll keep me informed. I might come with you somewhere. What about a Bluebell or somewhere like that, or maybe Oxford, or we could do the Oxford session there. Have a few beers for your birthday with Paul, maybe.
Yeah, quite possibly. One or two beers, because it'll be cold. I remember back on Elster when I didn't drink quite a bit, I kind of ditched the beers in the winter and just drunk a bottle of red wine each night instead, because you don't have to get up and pee every 5 minutes.
we used to have
not to be recommended.
We used to have Stella's for breakfast on there, didn't we?
Yeah, it's shameless goes carp fishing.
Yeah, well, you'll hear more about the Elso social days on next week's show, because we talk about that quite a bit with Paul Harris, don't we?
We do, yes.
So we might as well wrap it up. It's goodbye from me.
Be seeing you.
Be seeing you.
Simply, simply lovely.
www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.